Under pressure to bring in new business, lawyers sometimes lose sight of the applicable rules on client solicitation, attorney advertising, and other professional conduct issues. That's something I've actually seen from a couple different perspectives at Alas. First, as a lawyer in the claims department, and now as Senior Vice President of Law Firm Management Services and Loss Prevention. I'm Mary Beth Robinson, and you're listening to The Portable Ethics Lawyer. To review the rules, we're joined today by Terry Garland, Vice President and Senior Loss Prevention Counsel at Alas. Welcome, Terry.
Thanks, Mary Beth. It's good to be on this side of the interview for a change.
It's nice to have you. Terry, we hear about lawyers who attend business development seminars and come back all fired up with plans to contact potential clients. That's a good thing, but there are risks for lawyers who don't follow the rules, right?
That's for sure.
Let's start with an example. Take a lawyer in the pharmaceutical industry who targets all of the big pharma companies in his area for his business development efforts. He decides that he's going to send them a few articles he's written about developments relevant to them, along with his professional bio, and then he'll follow up later. Anything wrong with that?
That's fine in general, but it's all about the details. In that example, the lawyer needs to be aware of three things. First, the material he sends them can't be false or misleading. Now, you may be thinking that's obvious. No one should have to tell lawyers not to lie. But it's more nuanced than that. We're aware of professional liability claims involving so-called resume fraud, where a plaintiff alleges that in pitching for the business, the lawyer inflated his experience or credentials. Later, when the matter doesn't turn out as well as the client had hoped, the client sues the lawyer, arguing that it was the lawyer's lack of experience that led to the disappointing result. What does this mean? It means that if a lawyer hasn't handled a particular type of deal, she shouldn't give the client the impression that she has. And if a lawyer has never tried a case, he really shouldn't let the client think he has.
What else should the lawyer consider?
Well, second, the lawyer needs to find out whether the relevant state rules require him to label the information as advertising material or something similar. In many situations, ABA Model Rule 7.3 required labeling, at least until August of last year, that is, when the rule was revised to remove that requirement. But most states haven't adopted the revised rule yet, and they still require advertising materials to be labeled. Some states even require lawyers to submit advertising materials to the state bar for advance review and approval.
So you mentioned three things to consider. What's the third?
The third thing is that lawyers should consider any other type of content that is required or forbidden under the relevant rules. Required content commonly includes things like the lawyer's full name and contact information. Forbidden content typically includes terms like specialized or expert, unless the lawyer meets certain certification requirements. At many firms, the general counsel or the marketing department will review business development materials for these terms and other issues. If your firm provides that service, you should take advantage of it and have them review your information before you send it.
What if the lawyer's marketing effort is not so general? For example, what if a practice group sets up a system to monitor lawsuits filed in their jurisdiction and contacts companies that have been sued to pitch them for defending the case?
Well, now we're getting into a more dangerous area. This practice has been called docket mining, and some states have passed rules regulating it in certain practice areas. For example, Pennsylvania Rule 7.3 forbids contacting anyone who has been named as a defendant or respondent in a domestic relations case until the proof of service appears on the docket. Some states impose waiting periods before contacting the victim in a personal injury case. And federal law imposes a 45-day no solicitation rule after an airline disaster.
But what if we're talking about more traditional commercial litigation?
There's still a need for caution. In addition to the three issues we discussed with our first example, the lawyer must make sure to check for conflicts before contacting the defendant. And if the lawyer has reason to believe the defendant is already represented by counsel in the matter, then the no-contact rule in Model Rule 4.2 prevents the lawyer from contacting the defendant without that lawyer's permission, which he's unlikely to get. Finally, I want to make clear that we're still talking about sending a letter. If the mode of communication changes, that can make a big difference.
Okay, well, let's change the facts of our example. What if the lawyer picks up the phone and calls, or sends a letter first and then calls to follow up?
Then it's a whole different situation. The rules really disfavor what they call live person-to-person contact, because ethics authorities see that type of contact as presenting the greatest risk of potential overreaching by lawyers. For that reason, Model Rule 7.3 prohibits lawyers from soliciting clients by live person-to-person contact, unless an exception applies.
Okay, I do want to get to the exceptions, but first, can you tell us, how is live person-to-person contact defined?
Comment 2 to the rule explains that it includes face-to-face meetings, phone calls, and any other communication where the person is subject to a direct personal encounter without time for reflection. That time pressure creates a risk that pushy lawyers will coerce clients into signing on with them.
All right, so our entrepreneurial lawyer can send a letter to the company that's been sued, but by the time that company gets the letter, it's probably already hired counsel. What about sending an email or a text instead? Is that okay?
Good question. The rules have been criticized for failing to keep up with technology. Before they were revised last August, the rules prohibited solicitation by in-person, live telephone, or real-time electronic contact. And there was some confusion about the meaning of real-time electronic contact. Most ethics opinions on the issue have concluded that texts and emails don't qualify as a real-time electronic contact, but instead are subject to the rules for written communications. On the other hand, there are a few ethics opinions out there that disagree with that conclusion.
Didn't the August 2018 revision clear this up?
It sure tries. Revised Rule 7.3 substitutes a single category, live person-to-person contact, for the three categories in the old rule, in-person, live telephone, and real-time electronic contact. It's all one thing now, live person-to-person contact. Comment 2 to the revised rule says that this category does not include text and other written communications that recipients may easily disregard. So now we know that the rule doesn't apply to text. And while the comment doesn't talk about email messages, they're pretty easy to disregard, as we all know from having missed an important email from time to time. So I would argue that emails aren't covered by the rule on live person-to-person contact either.
Well, it sounds like the revised rule will make things a lot easier when it comes to texts and emails.
Over time, it will. There's just one problem in the short run. A state has to adopt the revised rule before it goes into effect there, and the majority of states haven't adopted the revised rule yet. Meanwhile, lawyers will want to make sure that their state isn't one of the few with an ethics opinion saying that emails are subject to the same rules as in-person solicitation.
Well, let's get back to the exceptions to the rule against live in-person solicitation. Can you tell us about those?
Sure. Model Rule 7.3 recognizes three exceptions. First, there is an exception for contacting certain categories of people. Specifically, the rule does not prohibit live in-person solicitation of another lawyer, someone who has a family, close personal or prior business or professional relationship with a lawyer or law firm soliciting the business, or, and I quote, a person who routinely uses for business purposes the type of legal services offered by the lawyer, close quote. That's all one exception, the exception for the category of person solicited. It's important to know that this exception varies by jurisdiction. Some states do not recognize exceptions for contacts with other lawyers or those who routinely hire them, for example. But if your state does follow the model rule, then this exception means that it's okay to solicit business through face-to-face talks or phone calls with in-house counsel, former clients, current clients, and several other types of folks.
Okay, lawyers should check with their general counsel or loss prevention partner before relying on this exception. What about the other exceptions?
The next two are easy. Exception number 2 allows solicitations authorized by law or ordered by a court or other tribunal. That could be certain contacts with members of a class, for example. And exception number 3 allows solicitations related to certain prepaid or group legal service plans. I also want to mention something else. Although the text of Model Rule 7.3 doesn't contain an explicit exception for pro bono work, some authorities have implied an exception for that, on the reasoning that solicitation requires a motivation for pecuniary gain, which doesn't apply for pro bono work. This is another area where lawyers should check with their general counsel before relying on the exception.
So we've covered general mailings, targeted letters, emails, texts. But what about if, for example, a tax lawyer meets the CFO of a Fortune 500 company at a social event? Can the lawyer try to win some business there?
She can, as long as she follows the rules and watches the details. One thing she could do is avoid offering to provide legal services in a specific matter. To quote Model Rule 7.3a, solicitation is a communication that is directed to a specific person the lawyer knows, or reasonably should know, needs legal services in a particular matter, and that offers to provide, or reasonably can be understood as offering to provide, legal services for that matter. So instead of saying, "I'd like a shot at representing your company and challenging the new tax regulation our state passed last month," the lawyer might identify herself as a tax attorney and mention a few highlights of her background as they fit into the conversation naturally, making sure that she doesn't reveal any confidential information about her clients, of course. Then she could follow up with the CFO in an email.
But what if the CFO asks the lawyer about the new tax regulation?
Great. Comment 1 to Rule 7.3 says a communication is not a solicitation if it's a response to a request for information. But other considerations still apply. The lawyer might want to say a few words about the regulation in general, but she should also say that without checking for conflicts, she can't advise the CFO about his company's specific situation, and he shouldn't tell her any confidential information. She can offer to check conflicts and circle back to talk further if everything checks out. If the CFO is interested, they can exchange contact information and go from there. We provide more information about responding to requests for legal advice at social events in our September 2018 podcast on that topic.
Anything else you'd like to cover, Terry?
Sure. I'd just like to mention that lawyers should be aware of the rules on accepting referral fees and splitting fees with non-lawyers. But we'll leave those rules for another day.
Great. Well, thanks for being here, Terry.
Thank you, Mary Beth.
Until next time, I'm Mary Beth Robinson, and this is The Portable Ethics Lawyer.
This podcast is provided for educational purposes to assist lawyers in avoiding ethics violations, malpractice suits, other professional liability claims, and management liability claims. This podcast does not constitute legal advice and is not intended to establish an attorney-client relationship, nor is it intended to suggest or establish standards of care applicable to particular lawyers in any given situation. The recommendations contained in this podcast are not necessarily appropriate for every lawyer or law firm. In determining the best course of action, lawyers should consider the applicable legal authorities and all relevant facts and circumstances. Copyright 2019 by Attorneys Liability Assurance Society. All rights reserved.